Speak your mind with your online group. Build a better group. Use the newest voice conferencing service available. TalkShoe. Talk with everyone. TalkShoe. That's TalkShoe.com.
TalkShoe. Recorded live.
Welcome to Mythologic Radio, where science meets spirituality. Join Tom Morasso and Cheryl Dobbins as they take you on a journey of self-discovery. Let your inner being travel to places you have never been before. Discover what lies buried in the recesses of time and space. Is it real or an illusion? Your only choice is to resonate with what you hear or not.
And welcome everybody to a special Monday night edition of Mythologic Radio. My name is Tom Morasso, and my co-host is Cheryl Dobbins. Cheryl, are you there?
I am.
Hello.
It's my friend.
Okay, great. Okay, great. Last Thursday, I was joking with David that the world management team did not want him on the air, so we rescheduled for tonight, and thanks for everybody for coming back. We're going to have a really great show, and Cheryl, you know, David really doesn't need any introduction. He's a professional lecturer, filmmaker, researcher of ancient civilizations, consciousness science, and new paradigms of matter and energy. He's got an upcoming Hollywood film called Convergence, which unveils the proof that all life on Earth is united in a field of consciousness, which affects our minds in fascinating ways. And David's also the subject and co-author of that international bestseller, The Reincarnation of Edgar Cayce, which explores remarkable similarities between David and Edgar. And it features many of David's most inspiring psychic readings and reveals documented NASA scientific proof of interplanetary climate change and how it directly impacts our DNA. And so I'm real excited to have David with us tonight. We're not going to sit around and do a lot of chit-chat between us because we got a lot to talk about. So, folks, welcome Mr. David Wilcock. How are you, David?
Well, I'm doing very well. It's been a wild couple of weeks here, but I think the timing of our show is really good. There's a lot of stuff going on in the world right now we can talk about, and I'm having a great day. It's an absolutely gorgeous view right now. The weather here in Malibu is just absolutely perfect.
You know, I was looking at your website, and you seem like you are one busy guy because you must have about 4 to 5 or 6 things coming up in the next few months, cruises and all sorts of conferences and all sorts of really cool stuff, and I wish I was closer to you, but maybe by osmosis I can absorb some of it. Why don't you tell everybody real quick what's going on with your...
Well, there are a series of events that I have coming up, and let me pull up the website because there's so many of them that I can't remember my schedule for.
Yeah, it was just amazing.
I do kind of feel like a rock star because, I mean, you called me and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right, we have a show. You know, I used to go to the rock concert, like Guns N' Roses was the worst. They'd delay, like, sometimes 2 hours before they were supposed to actually go on, before they would show up. And I've just been working, you know, there's so much going on and I got so many balls I'm trying to keep in the air at the same time. And you called me, and I'm like, yeah, all right, I can do a radio show right now. All right, so the first thing I have going on is on April 23rd. It's south of L.A. It's called the Mind, Body, Spirit Business Network. People get to go there, and they can talk about whatever their business is and network with other people. So it's a great opportunity for people to meet. It's in Costa Mesa, and that's on the website, divinecosmos.com. You can read more about that. I'll be doing a keynote speech that night. There's a really nice, inexpensive one people can hit in San Francisco the weekend of April 25th. All you have to do to see my 2012 Enigma talk is pay a $10 day pass. And then if you wanted to see my other talk, which is sort of like a group reading called Awaken to Your True Purpose, that's $45, which is actually really low. That particular organizer insists on having really low rates. So if you go to that one, it's quite affordable. Then the Mind, Body, Spirit Network in Costa Mesa, again, I'm doing a full day with Robert Perala. He's a great friend of mine. He's written a couple books. Divine Blueprint is one of them. And he also worked for a long time with Sir Paul McCartney, helping out with the Landmine charity that he was involved with. He was centrally involved in that. And he's a contactee. He's been through UFO experiences, and we just get along really well. He's a great guy. I'm really honored to be speaking with him. I have a big thing coming up in Hawaii, May 16th through the 18th. It's Exopolitics International. There's a keynote speech I'm delivering at a dinner banquet. You pay $75 and you have the dinner included as well as the talk, and you'll get the chance to meet me. There's also a post-conference workshop. Now, some people asked about this. There is a dolphin swim that morning. I will be at the dolphin swim. I will probably do some impromptu talks at the swim, but it's primarily not my event. After the swim is over, you go back to the hotel again, and then I have this talk called Preparing for 2012, which is essentially the Awakening to Your True Purpose again. And we're hoping to get a lot of local Hawaii people for that one. Then there's something, there's a kind of a women's festival called the Harmony Festival in Santa Rosa, California. That's June 6th to the 8th. We haven't firmed up exactly what I'm saying there, but it'll probably be another 2012 lecture. I've been doing a lot of work with the American Society of Dowsers. That's August 9th through 12th. That's where people on the East Coast will be able to hit something if they want to. It's the only East Coast event that I've lined up right now. Dowsing is not just about searching for water. It's also a divination method. So when you go there, you're basically learning how to tune in to your higher self and be able to get accurate guidance. And I've just actually submitted a unique speech summary for them, which we're going to be posting pretty soon. I'm going to be putting out some of the most astonishing data of the Russian research into torsion fields. It will be the most comprehensive scientific presentation on that subject that I've ever given publicly, and I'll be tying it into the subject of dowsing, both in divination and in the sense of finding water.
Okay, where's that going to be on the East Coast?
That is it's at the Killington Grand Hotel and Conference Center in the Vermont Green Mountains. It's an absolutely fantastic resort. The keynote address, I'm not sure what they're charging for that one. I think you could go there just to see me, or you could do the larger conference. Then that's on Saturday, August 9th. Then on Tuesday, the 12th of August, there is a half-day workshop I'm doing. They also invited me to do a full day, but that would have stretched it out till Wednesday, and I don't want people to have to hang out longer than they need to. So we're going to do a half-day workshop on Tuesday, but that will also be quite extensive and will be like another group reading and an opportunity to, you know, when I do these larger, like the Awakening to Your True Purpose, what I'm really trying to do is lead the whole group through a healing process where they are dealing with their issues that they haven't faced in themselves that are holding them back from reaching their potential.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do this as a group, some really spontaneous and amazing things happen, and the people bond. We've even had people who ended up in long-term relationships as a result of meeting each other at these things.
Wow.
More than one case I could go into, but we don't really have the time. In San Francisco, the infamous Bay Area UFO Expo, which is one of my favorite events to speak at, September 28th to 29th, this is a who's who list of UFO personalities. It's a great hotel, and I was honored to be invited to that. That's September 28th to 29th. George Norrie is going to be there. Graham Hancock, Bob Dean, who's had a wonderful video with Project Camelot, and many others. And then lastly, and that's also going to be my 2012 talk, which will go past what's on the video that I put out on the website. Everybody can see now. And then the flagship, pun intended, is the Mexican Riviera cruise that I'm going to be doing. That's a whole week, Saturday to Saturday, November 8th to 15th. Last time we did one of these, we got bumped to Carnival at the last minute, and Carnival cruises are okay, but this is a much nicer one. This is the Princess Cruise Line. I actually am taking the lowest profit percentage that I could while still making it worth doing.
Uh-huh.
That drives the price down more than any other type of conference of somebody like me that would be done. And that was how we were able to get it down to $868 per person for double occupancy, or $1,178 per person double occupancy if you want to have your own private veranda with an outside room. Now, this is like a really amazing cruise. We go to Puerto Vallarta, Mazatlan, and Cabo San Lucas, and there's also 3 days at sea. So these are wonderful paradise destinations, tropical beaches and everything. I'm going to be going through a deeper exploration of 2012 prophecy as it relates to the Mayan calendar. These are long, extended lectures at sea, much more personal. You'll get much more of a chance to meet me. And again, these are the kind of things where the people really bond with each other. Kevin Fitzgerald is a really good friend of mine. He is ready and willing to take your phone calls to ask him questions about this or to find out more information. And his phone number is 951-805-1820. That's 951-805-1820. His name again is Kevin Fitzgerald. There are a couple other events floating around towards the end of the year, but we don't have them nailed down just yet. So you'll have to go back to the website and find out more. But, man, that is a busy schedule.
Thank you
for letting me say all that stuff. That was a relentless self-promotion I just did there, and I apologize. But
no, that's great, and people love you and want to see you. And I tell you, you brought up 2012, and you got this this video that's out now, the 2012 Enigma.
That's correct.
Let's see if we can touch a little bit on that subject.
Well, this was post-produced by yours truly. I had to basically dive in and learn how to use Sony Vegas video processing software in order to take the existing conference footage that we had and turn it into a video that was worth watching.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the people who were running the video production were having a lot of problems with the technology they were trying to use. They were not very familiar with it, and it is admittedly difficult to edit a video in real time so that you can have finished copy DVDs ready to be sold to people as soon as the thing is over. That's what they were trying to do.
Mm.
But in the process, they were neglecting the basic responsibilities in many cases of what's actually on the screen. So there were things happening like, you know, they would have the camera fixed on the wall for 45 seconds and I wasn't even in the shot. They were parking the camera on the slide that I had, which was just a few words, and never cutting back to my face at all for like 2 minutes in a row, which I thought was exasperating.
Mm-hmm.
And I just looked at this footage, and then the other thing was that a lot of the footage was the mic was getting overloaded, and so we were having trouble with the audio. It was basically inaudible. Now, I've had a lot of people email me, as I said, on the video I just did with Project Camelot the other day that will be released probably in a week. I'm getting 120 emails a day, and that is not an exaggeration. So, again, I'm really glad everybody's emailing, and I thank you so much for your support. I do apologize about the fact that it's just getting to be too unmanageable for me to reply to most of the emails. But anyway, a lot of people have emailed and said, oh, where's the rest of the footage? It's like, look, you know, this is the best of what there is, and the rest of it is basically unwatchable because of this audio problem. So anyway, to get to the meat of it, and you also, you know, we brought in the interplanetary climate change issue. 2012 has been talked about by a lot of people, and there is a lot of latitude that people feel they have to just debunk and discredit the whole thing and say there's really nothing to the idea that we're heading into any sort of singular moment of change in the planet. Now, there are a lot of ancient prophecies you can look at that show very definitively that there is a prophetic scenario which involves global unrest, social degradation, and also social integration, depending on how you look at it. Upheavals in terms of the government, upheavals in terms of gender relationships, race relationships, wars, rumors of wars, acts of violence and human cruelty and indignity, but at the same time, a blossoming of abilities in the average person that go far beyond what the typical human potential has been seen to be up until now. There's a lot of people having awakening experiences, and most of the time they're working with it alone, and you're seeing shows on NBC. These are big network television shows like Heroes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is all about ascension. It's all about the awakening of dormant potentials in the human mind-body-spirit complex, as you call it in the Law of One. And these things are unfamiliar, and people are puzzled by it. They're puzzled by the fact that the phone rings and they know who it is. They're puzzled by bumping into that person that they needed to be talking to at just the right moment in the grocery store. They're starting to have the walls of the consensus reality break down and see the greater context that their experiences illuminate, which is a context that cannot be explained by our conventional scientific paradigm. Now, all that's fine and good. That is definitely happening. But it's still a huge step to go from this sort of generalized idea that changes are happening on the planet to the idea that we're actually dealing with an intelligently designed and orchestrated cycle change in which a 26,000-year cycle is reaching completion, a cycle that can be measured by a slow wobble in the Earth's axis called the precession of the equinoxes, and that when we reach the end of this cycle, not only does the Earth experience a profound transformation, but in fact the entire solar system itself is actually moving into a higher frequency of energy. Now that sounds like an absurdly far-out concept. However, we have hard, undeniable evidence to prove, and I do say prove, which is not an easy statement to make in a scientific context, we can prove this is happening. We can prove that the sun's activity is at an all-time high that we haven't seen in over 11,000 years. We can prove recently that Mercury is experiencing anomalous energetic changes in its magnetic field. Venus has had a 2,500% increase in its brightness in a very short period of time, among other changes. Massive increase in the amount of ozone in the atmosphere. Mars is having clouds grow. There have been articles come out in mainstream science from NASA describing global warming on Mars, remarkable melting of the Martian polar ice caps. Then you go out to Jupiter, and the great red spot is changing color, and other spots are disappearing. And there are scientists saying that this could be causing Mars or Jupiter to experience a global warming of a very substantial amount in just 10 years. There's also a flux tube of energy going from Jupiter to its moon Io, which has caused the entire surface of the moon to heat up by 200% from where it was just 10, 15 years ago. And then all the other moons of Jupiter are experiencing remarkable brightness changes that should not be happening, indicating that they're having greater amounts of ozone. Then you go out to Saturn, and you're seeing a remarkable shift in the amount of X-ray activity that's coming out from near the equator. You're seeing the rings actually changing, where these spoke formations that used to be there are now disappearing and have disappeared. You're seeing the actual rotational speed of Saturn slowing down, which is supposedly impossible by any conventional celestial mechanical model. And again, you're seeing a tube of ionizing radiation around Saturn growing remarkably in brightness and in strength and in the density of the particles, just like you see around Jupiter. Then you go out to Uranus, and we're seeing, again, remarkable changes, clouds showing up, substantial brightness increases, substantial changes in the magnetic field. You go out to Neptune. We saw Neptune's near-infrared, which is just above visible range. The near-infrared light coming off of Neptune has gotten 40% brighter between 1996 and 2002. It literally looks like Neptune is a lampshade and somebody turned on the lamp inside. I mean, it's that much of a change in how the actual planet looks. It's huge. Neptune is having a substantial global warming. They cannot explain it. Then you go out to Pluto, and even though Pluto is moving away from the Sun, which should indicate that it's going into a colder region of space, it is nonetheless warming up and increasing in its temperature. And then, of course, that leads us back to the Earth, and there are a variety of studies on the Earth which suggest that it cannot be caused by carbon dioxide polluting the atmosphere, that global warming and whatever climate change you want to talk about cannot simply be that easy to explain. One of them is the fact that the bottom of the Pacific Ocean is heating up. And the scientists are ridiculous enough to say that the water molecules on the surface are being heated up by the sun and then sinking to the bottom and warming up the bottom, which is so ludicrous because, as we know, hot air rises, cold air sinks.
Right.
They're actually violating the most basic laws of thermodynamics to try to explain this. And, I mean, this, it just goes on and on and on. There's any number of studies on the Earth. We're seeing an increase in volcanic activity, an increase in earthquake activity, very substantial. And you can't explain that by carbon dioxide. So then it gets even more interesting when you find out that there's channeling from the 1950s, which I'll be going into at my lectures, that has never before been made public to any substantial degree. And this channeling was the precursor to the Law of One material. It was brought through by a series of people who did not know each other, and they were all independently getting the same stuff. There was one researcher named W.B. Smith who was going around interviewing these different groups. This is early 1950s, before it became such a fad like it is now. And this channeling repeatedly and redundantly was saying, in the 1950s, and we have books that have been published that you could buy on Amazon that tell you what's going on. And these channelings all said the same thing, that we were moving into a zone of energy in the galaxy that would have a higher energetic charge, that it would change all the planets in the solar system as well as the Earth, and that it would trigger a spontaneous mass evolutional metamorphosis into a higher consciousness on the planet.
Is that the photon belt?
The photon belt is sort of like a diluted version of the original insight.
Okay.
In fact, it appears that the photon belt was derived from people who had read these books, perhaps, and kind of were inspired to do their own spin-offs on it. Because these books were available as early as 1956 or earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So this material was around in the 50s, and people don't realize that, because back then it would have been a lot harder to say that you could have made this prediction. We didn't have satellites. We didn't have the instruments to be able to suggest that the planets could be changing. We didn't really have the ability to study them at that point. So I consider this to be a really substantial benchmark, because if you have those prophecies, they're documented, they're proven. You can buy the books and find it. So that makes it a lot more credible. And then they're making a direct connection, the sources speaking are making a direct connection between the climate change and a corresponding energetic change in humans' frequency level. So, again, the deeper subtext here is that I put together a scientific framework in which we can see how something that appears to be on a mundane level, nothing more than a change in temperature of the planets, actually does correspond to a change in consciousness, because effectively consciousness is another basic energy in the universe that has properties that are as simple and as straightforward as the difference between hot and cold. Except that when you're dealing with a hotter consciousness or a colder consciousness, you're dealing with a vibrational frequency level. And that actually does correspond directly to our level of intelligence, our level of psychic ability. One of my favorite things to bring up is if you look at the 20-year study of psychic phenomena that was compiled by Dr. James Spottiswood. He was looking to see if there was any time where the people in these studies were more psychic during a particular time of the day. And what he found was that when we have a particular relationship to the galactic center, in other words, our position in the galaxy determines how psychic we are, and when we make this particular relationship to the galactic center, which is like a 60-degree angle, like a sextile in astrology, that we actually become 400% more psychic. And that's been proven in 20 years' worth of studies. So
it's
you
almost
can make,
like tuning in. It's almost like tuning in an antenna.
Oh, yeah. I like to think of it as if there was a beam of energy coming from the center of the galaxy, and when we tune into that beam, our frequency changes, because ultimately what my research has concluded, and part of what my film is going to go into, is the sense that we've always thought that the mind is this function of the neurological activity in the brain, that basically it's a bunch of nerve cells firing off, and that's what we're thinking with. Well, there's a problem with that. It's a very simple problem. We have statistically documented, provable evidence that people have died and they're brain dead, and they have a continuity of experience. They keep thinking, they keep experiencing, but
right.
they're not in their body, and their body is showing no brainwave activity.
Right.
Well, how in the world could that be possible if the brainwave activity and the nerves in the brain were what you were using to think with? This actually implies that what you're using to think with, even as you hear my words right now, this is not something that excludes you. You're very much a part of this. As you're listening to me, it may very well be that what you're thinking with is almost entirely a phenomenon of energy and may not really involve your brain more than sort of like an antenna. The brain is basically tuning into your field to transduce your thoughts, which may be coming from this unseen energy pattern.
Yeah,
now, of course,
consciousness.
Right. And then you can talk about the difference between sort of online and offline thinking. And offline thinking would be thinking that's generated from the body, which you will have. Obviously, you're going to have regulatory mechanisms in the medulla that will keep your heart pumping and keep your, cerebrospinal fluid flowing and keep the white blood cells going where they need to go and doing their healing and all these autonomic nervous system functions. That probably is not running too much on the energy field. And there's going to be things like, if your stomach gets hungry, it's going to send a hunger signal to your brain. That's probably an offline phenomenon. But any of the more involved thinking, anything that's more cognitive, analytical, all those functions seem to be occurring in the energy field. And this would also explain why you can separate the skin cells from someone's mouth and store them vast distances away from where they are, as long as the cells are still alive. And those cells will respond to the shocks that that person has. They will electrically spike when the person's own body is showing a sudden electrical change from having a shock reaction. And there's no distance that has ever been found that's a theoretical limit to how far that travels. So it also indicates right there that that your DNA molecule is like an antenna and that your consciousness is actually a non-local field. So this is really what we're dealing with. Consciousness is a non-local field, and your mind, to some degree, is a function of its environment. In fact, to a large degree. That's one of my new catchphrases. Your mind is a function of its environment. There's been a lot
like
of really,
that.
Yeah. There's a lot of really stressful stuff going on with the planet right now, and I'm sure that everybody who's been listening to this, if you're anything like the rest of the friends I've been talking to, we've been getting kicked in the crotch the last couple of weeks. I mean, can I get an amen on that or what?
Amen.
My God. The last 2 weeks have been really rough. And all kinds of stuff is getting stirred up, and it has just been an incredible roller coaster ride. And I think there's a very good reason, and this lets me kind of segue back into our political discussion. I want to just put a timestamp on this since it's in the middle of what we're experiencing right now. I'm seeing a lot of negative publicity coming out about Barack Obama from the alternative conspiracy-oriented media. I think they're, in some cases, so addicted to looking for people's problems, that's all they're seeing. Now, I'm inclined to distrust politicians myself, and I've seen all the hit pieces that have been written on Obama, and I've seen all the hit pieces written on the other candidates. What I'm trying to say is that as someone who has documented repeated psychic accuracy over, the better part of a decade online with things that I wrote that then came true, and a source of guidance that many people have trusted as being of positive nature, I am getting very reliable, consistent dreams in which I'm interacting with Barack Obama directly and in which I'm seeing that his impact on the planet no matter what happens, whether he gets elected or not, that he will be revered and held in high esteem for many, many generations after this time. I think that it is a slippery slope for anyone to endorse a politician for the simple fact that politics is inherently fraught with controversy, and it divides people into artificial categories of Democrat or Republican, in which there's a lot of values that our nation is divided along in terms of whether they want to, you know, think in a liberal manner or in a conservative manner. I really was impressed with his speech on race relations. I thought that was amazingly courageous to come out and just call something out on the table like that. And I really think, whether you like him or not, you have to admit that that is a progressive step. To step out of this... You were going to say something?
No, I think that's a bad choice.
You know, to step out of this politically correct, where you never want to take a risk and you never want to stick your neck out and you're trying to be as safe as possible, and for him to come out and make that kind of a speech and just basically call attention to something that we're all dealing with but we're not facing, that's really what I see the evolution of this planet being about. The evolution of this planet really is about each person starting to realize these shadow aspects inside ourselves where we have voluntarily held back from being able to reach out and embrace others as a projection of ourselves. And there's no greater way in which that is divided than in race relations. We've seen an undue amount of racism that's always been sublimated in various politically correct forms, where you don't really talk about it directly, but you talk about it in terms of welfare reform, or you talk about it in terms of healthcare reform or various other things. And what's happening now is that some of these issues that have been smoldering ever since basically the Civil War or before are now coming out in the open and being discussed. And a similar type of turning point was actually happening in the Monica Lewinsky scandal. I was getting readings back then saying that if the mass public was to condemn Clinton for his actions, that there would be a karmic reprisal, because how the mass mind, in terms of what the average person thinks, how that mass mind functions really does relate to the state of the Earth's health. And I was actually warned that many of the 1998 prophecies of Earth changes could have come true if the public unified in a mass of disgust and hatred towards Clinton for what he had been through. And the reason why is that it would have been blatant, naked hypocrisy, because this is what everybody's doing. And I say everybody knowing that that's a blanket generalization. Not everybody is doing this, but a substantial number of people have been involved in infidelity in their marriage, or they've been involved in, everybody to some degree has been involved in dishonorable or untruthful behavior. And I think that's part of the human experience. We're built to be confused. We're not built to figure it out and get all our spiritual stuff nailed down.
Uh-huh.
So what I'm actually suggesting, and I said it in the Project Camelot video as well, is that whether Obama wins or not, we are seeing in progress, in real time, a bloodless coup taking place in which ruling families that have been in control at least since the foundation of the Federal Reserve in 1913 are finally being exposed and rooted out and essentially removed from power. And I had a really powerful visionary dream about it this morning, showing the extent to which this is going to happen. I do believe 2008 is the year we're going to see a lot of these things get stirred up and even maybe discussed openly. And I do think that the media is going to be changing from its perspective of being so controlled and only giving the puppeteer's voice. So it's really fascinating to me what's happening right now. And Richard Hoagland and I have been having a lot of discussion about this on the phone. We're really actually starting to see the 2012 prophecies coming true, even in the most sarcastically vindictive and resilient to change parts of our society, like the media and politics. We're really seeing massive shifts taking place. the two-faced duplicity, people are not standing for it anymore. I think the fact that Hillary hasn't conceded to the fact that she's already lost, it's mathematically impossible for her to win the Democratic nomination. The very fact that she's not giving in and that she's continuing to try to fight this thing, the only way she could win now is by some kind of dirty trick of luring people away from the majority plural vote. And it's like everybody's just kind of sitting there in awe going, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. But when
Go ahead. I was just going to say, why don't you bring Ron Paul into the mix, too, since you're giving Obama and Hillary. What do you feel about him?
Well, again, I think Ron Paul's candidacy was definitely along the exact same lines that we've been talking about in terms of a progressive movement. And he did capture the imagination of a lot of people. You know, he raised a substantial amount of money. And also, his platforms, though I didn't agree with all of them, to a very large degree, he was talking exactly in the type of language that we needed more of, in the sense that we have had an unduly restrictive federal government. You know, I did spend, 8 years living in the Deep South, and while I was there, I learned the other side of the Abraham Lincoln coin, which is very controversial to discuss. But the fact of the matter is that some people in the South say that slavery was only an issue that was put on the front of something, sort of like how they say, well, the Patriot Act is going to protect you from terrorists. But then they put all these draconian measures in it that are going to restrict and eliminate your freedom. In much the same way, it appears from some of the things I've heard from people in the South that... And they're not coming from a racist perspective either. I might add that very important caveat, that the slavery was used as sort of the open issue to conceal deeper issues that were then basically involved in the consolidation of a federal empire and removing of the individual liberties of the states as sort of sovereign governorships that can rule their own people as sort of like a commonwealth where the people get to rule on a state level and have most of the power. I don't believe that Abraham Lincoln personally wanted that to happen. I think that like in many cases, like what was happening with Kennedy before he turned, that Lincoln kind of got caught in the middle of something that became a lot more monstrous than he realized. I do think that's part of why he got assassinated, is that maybe he started to realize what was happening, that he was building this behemoth that was going to get out of control. It didn't take that long either because, you know, the federal government consolidation did kind of reach its apex with the Federal Reserve in 1913, the consolidation of the money supply. Ron Paul was talking about all this stuff that so many people are reading about online now about, you know, he didn't use the word Illuminati, but it was strongly implied. And
right.
Absolutely. So he was making huge inroads into the public consciousness. And the problem with his candidacy, the reason why, for all intents and purposes, he has essentially conceded, you know, the game. I mean, if you see some of the statements he's made, he's basically focused on, you know, winning his own congressional election. And
mm-hmm.
he didn't want to run unless he was going to be the Republican nominee, and that obviously has now gone to McCain. So I don't really think that the problem is he's in some ways he was similar to Huckabee. I mean, a lot of people dissed Huckabee because he was a fundamentalist Christian and whatnot. But Huckabee was saying, let's get rid of the IRS. And, you know, these kind of ideas, while they are very progressive and certainly in the right direction and a much better direction, there's too many people who are still asleep, and they just look at this kind of stuff and say, well, you know, that's too scary. I can't imagine that much change happening. I can't imagine,
right.
you know, hiring somebody to run the country who's going to rip up everything that we've ever done.
Right.
But isn't that what we're trying to do, David, as a consciousness? Aren't we trying to separate the fear and the love and go to things through a love vibration to start to change things?
Absolutely.
I mean, that is exactly, you know, if Ron Paul didn't do anything else, if Dennis Kucinich didn't do anything else, what they did is they started showing people that there is other perceptions of things besides what we've been taught to be in the box all this time.
Absolutely. I really cannot emphasize enough the value of Ron Paul's candidacy and the things that he started in motion, the discussions that were opened, and the sheer number of people who were awakened by what he was saying.
And also the other candidates, I feel, maybe started to open their perception a little bit by what he was saying because they were so close-minded to a lot of things.
There's no question. There's no question that I think all of the other candidates, the platforms and the way that they speak, were affected by Ron Paul more than you're ever going to see publicly acknowledged. And that includes Obama, too. I mean, I think everybody saw, wow, this is a grassroots campaign that came up out of nowhere like a brush fire and threatened to burn down the whole game. And you can absolutely guarantee that if there was any type of fair play involved in giving Ron Paul anywhere near an equal amount of campaign time as the other Republican nominees like Romney and Huckabee and McCain and Giuliani and whatnot, there's no doubt in my mind that he would be much farther ahead, and he may have even beat McCain. It was very unfairly manipulated against him. And unfortunately, I was getting dreams. I'm sorry?
That the shift is starting now, that the shift is apparent. It's upon us.
Oh, no doubt about it. Anytime that you have these type of issues breaching directly into daily public discourse, so many people were saying, Google Ron Paul, Google Ron Paul, and it was like everywhere you looked, there was new articles coming out about him. In fact, Dig.com, which is actually a more popular website than Drudge Report, they started to actually have berry brigades that were specifically suppressing Ron Paul articles because there were so many people writing about it and publicizing his candidacy. And he really did capture the internet youth culture to an amazing degree. But again, in that case, the dirty tricks won out. And the average American who watches television and newspapers and isn't as tuned into the internet didn't get the chance to really be exposed to him in a fair fashion. And another thing which, you know, this is a little bit edgy to say this, but Richard Hoagland and I also have had this discussion. Because Ron Paul is a conservative, and because that implies a real judicious weighing out of how dollars are going to be spent, there is a certain sense of adventurousness that could have been used in his campaign financing that he was receiving from the public. And a lot more could have been done with the millions that he raised than what was done. He can brag about the fact that he paid all his bills and he has no debt after the campaign, but you can make a movie for $2 to $5 million, which is what we're doing. And so, you know, there definitely could have been some aggressive deployment of that money to reaching the larger American public that didn't happen. And that's another one of those things where if you want to cry sour grapes, you can look back and say, maybe we could have done this, maybe we could have done that. But nonetheless, he absolutely did advance the discourse forward. And
that's
I'm very
a good
grateful
point.
For that.
That's a good point. Hey, you know, I got a lot of people on here that they haven't called in, but they can chat. So
okay.
They keep saying pineal gland. Ask David about the pineal gland.
Okay.
So I'm asking you.
All right. This gets into material that we talked about in 2012 Enigma, the video. Now, I don't really want to necessarily go over stuff that you've already seen, because I imagine if you haven't seen the movie, you're going to go see it. It's free. It's an hour and a half long. You can watch it on Google or YouTube. Just look up 2012 Enigma. And what I'm discussing, just to give sort of the overview of it before I go into some new material that's not on the video, is this. It's a very fascinating thing. It turns out that we have a hyperdimensional stargate that is part of our human physiology. It's built in. And this stargate functions by the fact that simple, ordinary water, when shielded off from all the electromagnetic references to our existing third-dimensional space-time, that water can shift and have a connection made to an inverted reality, if you might so call it, in which space and time are in an inverse relationship to each other. You have three dimensions of time and one dimension of space. So when you pop over into time-space, as it's called, you're basically stuck in space. You can't really move around because now you only have one dimension. But wherever you go, you have three-dimensional access to time. You can actually move around in time as if you were moving around in space in our world. So you can actually fast forward and rewind time very easily. It all has to do with where you punch in. So this is accomplished to some degree by the fact that there are tiny little molecules in the water, which in this case is the water inside the pineal gland, and these little molecules are called microclusters. You can take a gas and shoot it out through a nozzle to the point where one atom comes out of the gas at a time, and that's called adiabatic expansion. And when you do that, the molecules do not form random clusters. They actually form little geometric clusters, and they're called microclusters. The geometry is the basic forms of the platonic solids, the cube, the octahedron, tetrahedron, icosahedron, dodecahedron. You'll see all those shapes depicted in the 2012 Enigma video, and you'll get much more information about all these things I'm talking about, so you'll be able to understand this. It won't go over your head. Anyway, the point is that the microclusters form another sort of resonant gateway that allows us to transition to time-space. And this is a little gland inside your brain, which is actually doing this when it gets fired up. The way that it gets fired up is what we would call kundalini activation. You feel it as a pressure or a buzzing or a ringing inside your head. And when that happens, you're getting a complex series of electromagnetic intersecting, they're almost like rings of energy that spin around in different directions. And they ultimately form sort of an impervious electromagnetic shield around this water inside your pineal gland. And when that happens, your pineal gland gates over into time-space, and it can be directed to some degree by your conscious focus, and that also is determined by how the electromagnetic activity functions. Now, I was getting this happening to me for years. I'd be sitting there, and inexplicably, all of a sudden, I'd get this ringing in my ears, almost like a gong had been bonged off near my head, except that it was like, it felt like the pressure of a gong, but then there was no sound. And I'd be going, what the hell is that? What the hell is that? And then people around me would be like, are you okay? Because they wouldn't hear anything. But then I'd start to notice that I would seem to go into more of a visionary consciousness when this would happen. And it also seemed to be happening at certain very important synchronistic moments for me. Moments when all this stuff was lining up in my life to show me, okay, whatever you were just thinking about, that's the right thing. You're on the right track, and this is where you should be going in your thought process. So it took a while to realize that when I was going in to do a psychic reading and contact my own higher self, that I would experience a massive feeling of speeding up in this part of my head, in what they call the third eye, and that actually does represent a gland that is being activated. Now, it was reverse engineered by ancient Atlantean society. This is another really fascinating point. You can build the basic system, which is just this barrel of water that has a particularly treated form of water inside where those microclusters can be invoked. And then you recreate the electromagnetic field around it, which in this case is a series of three rings that can then spin inside of each other in different directions. And it's all been depicted in the movie Contact, the actual Stargate that is given by this extraterrestrial species, downloaded through the SETI program and then rebuilt by humans on Earth, which Jodie Foster actually goes through a Stargate as a result of them building this thing. What you see in the movie Contact is almost exactly what it looks like. And I go into all that in 2012 Enigma, so you can see all those slides. You can actually see slides that Dan Burrish made of what the actual device itself looks like. And this is apparently a workable technology that has been used ever since at least the 1950s by our government. They've done it, they've used it for a variety of things to try to see things that were coming in the future. not from Burrish, but from other people. I have heard that they saw 9/11 coming in advance with the looking glass, as it's called. This is the name of the technology. And that it wasn't necessarily that they created it themselves, but that they saw that it was going to happen and that they might have helped it along because they saw that it was coming. And then we do hear from Burrish, actually, I think it was from Burrish, but I don't want to pin this on him. It could have been somebody else because I've had 7 different witnesses talk about Looking Glass. We have heard some of them say that 9/11, there were timelines in which 9/11 did not happen and that something far worse happened instead. So they basically saw that from their limited viewpoint, allowing 9/11 to happen was better than what would happen afterwards, which appeared to be more like a nuclear attack.
Yeah, the end of the arc.
Yeah. And I actually did get a psychic vision of a potential nuclear strike on New York in 1998, and I called the FBI, and then they started to tap my phone. And, because back then I didn't have any internet presence, and I'd had 2.5 years of experience doing psychic readings very accurately. And I thought I would be given a warm reception, and they would invite me into their offices and interview me as a psychic.
Yeah, well, they thought you were just going to do it.
They took all my testimony down over the phone, and then they never contacted me again, except to tap my phone and listen in on all these other phone calls I was having.
Mm-hmm.
And I got really angry, especially when they were listening in on calls with my mother. You'd hear these audible clicks on the phone when I'd say certain keywords like extraterrestrial or alien.
Yeah.
And it was horrible. And they finally left me alone because they realized that I was not a terrorist and that I actually was psychic. The date that I was given for when they were going to blow up the nuke, I actually was given an exact day. It turned out to be the exact day, and this was on July 1st that I got this, the exact day that Clinton came forward and testified that he had, in fact, had sex with that woman. Now,
yeah.
You can imagine. It shocked the heck out of me. You can imagine. I mean, I don't want to doom prognosticate here, but imagine the success of somebody like bin Laden if on the very day that our president says that he lied and had sex with that woman, that all of a sudden the whole city goes up in a nuke. That would have been a spectacular terrorist attack unlike anything imaginable. And then you notice what happens right after Clinton gives that testimony on August 17th. He bombs 2 different countries, Sudan and Afghanistan, for an imminent, massive, undisclosed terrorist threat that was averted. Right? And that's, so he was punishing them, and everybody's kind of like, what the hell is he doing, and why did he do that? And, you know, New York, the Grand Central was shut down. So I've heard from other intel sources that I actually did psychically pinpoint something that many people were getting, both from psychic knowledge as well as from actual intel, that there was this thing planned, that it did get really close to happening, and that it was averted. So in that sense, I'm glad that I took the risk. I mean, I knew that calling the FBI was insane, but I couldn't have it on my conscience of having millions of people die. Now, this
right.
is just an example of, like, what you can do when you activate your pineal gland, and I know that's what people are really asking for. I kind of alluded to in the video you can activate your pineal gland, but then I don't really go into a whole lot of detail about it. I do want to point out that it is a timeless technique. The primary essence of it is meditation. It is a technique that involves essentially clearing out the detritus in your mind that interrupts the field. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. And I apologize for being such a monologue here, but it's very difficult to try to get all this out in 1 hour.
No problem. In fact, you know how we are. If you want to keep talking, just go for it.
Great.
We don't have to lock it down to an hour.
Because I'm definitely telepathically trying to get you to listen to what I'm saying. So go ahead and say what you got to say.
Well, if you can grant me an extension, that's perfect. Because I don't know. I didn't know if you guys were going to get arbitrarily cut off at 6 o'clock my time or what. But
no,
you're a granite, son. You're
all right.
Granite.
So let's keep this party going then. Okay. So anyway, getting back
activating.
To the I'm sorry?
Activating it.
Activating the pineal gland, right. Now this is material that I didn't really get into before, and it's not on the video, so this is some new stuff for you. The first book I ever read, now this part is in the video, but then I'm going to expand on it. The first book I ever read, which was an adult-length paperback, was called How to Make ESP Work for You. And this was a book I read when I was 7 years old. And I'm not lying. I actually did have just enough reading ability to be able to go through a book and sort of use context to figure out all the words I didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had been so enamored with the psychic experiences I'd already had, which culminated in an out-of-body experience when I was 5, that I could not explain. It was not a dream. It was definitely something other than a dream, where I floated out of my body and saw myself sleeping in bed, and then I started to go down the stairwell, and I got scared, and I popped back into my body, and I said, you know, if I hadn't have been scared, maybe I would have gone somewhere really amazing, because I'd had so many UFO dreams. And I didn't know what they were, and I didn't know who I was talking to. They always kind of showed up as these men in robes. But I said, you know, maybe I would have gone and met these guys, and something would have happened, and I felt like a failure. So after a couple of years, I said to my mom, you know, this is what happened, and I've been trying to get back there, and it's not working. What do I do? Is there anything I could read about this that might help me to get in there? And she said, well, this is all called ESP. And if you read some books on ESP, you might get another chance if you could develop your ability. So she actually had these books in a area under the basement staircase, and it was actually short enough that I could go in and reach for them as a little kid. So I found this book, among others. I read 2 books on hypnosis. I dabbled in some other books, but the one that really fascinated me the most was this book by Harold Sherman, How to Make ESP Work for You. And as I say in the video, he did a series of pioneering psychic experiments with Sir Hubert Watkins in the 1930s, and Watkins was an explorer of the Antarctic. And, you know, nobody'd been to Antarctica before, and so this was really some amazing stuff. Or it might have been the Arctic, actually. I think it might have been the North Pole. But either way, it was some really pioneering stuff. And Watkins and Sherman were documenting telepathic experiments because at that time it was the farthest way you could go from Los Angeles was the Arctic. So they would have journals and they'd write down at certain times of the day that they'd agree to try to read each other's mind what their impressions were. Watkins would write down what had happened to him that day and what he was trying to send to Sherman. Sherman would write down what he was experiencing. Watkins was picking up things on Sherman, like, you know, Sherman was supposed to have a dinner party, and then he missed it at the last minute. He missed his flight. Watkins nailed that. Sherman is nailing things from Watkins, like at one point they find a dead dog when they're out. One of their sled dogs had been killed and mutilated. Sherman nailed that one right down to the day. And over again, they were doing this stuff. It's still, to this day, it's one of the best documented distant telepathy studies in the history of parapsychology.
Mm-hmm.
But what a lot of people don't realize is that Watkins died and came to Sherman after his death and gave him messages via what we would call channeling. And this is really the only time that Sherman ever came out in the open and said that he was channeling. Now, Sherman also ended up going into the government stuff and did. He was one of the pioneers in remote viewing in the 1970s. A lot of people don't realize that also. But he was one of the early remote viewers who worked with Ingo Swann SRI International. And we don't really know what he did in there. There's really no written testimony of it that I've found so far. But anyway, he did get this in the late 1950s. He got this channeling coming in from Watkins. And the main thing Watkins was doing was explaining what he had to do as a disembodied spirit to try to get a message through to Sherman's mind. And he gave such an interesting description. It has never ceased to fascinate me. If you cut an onion open and you look inside, what you're going to see is a series of spheres, right? They're little layers of the onion. And each one of them by and of itself, if you peel off the layer above it, it's going to look like a little onion. And you're going to get more and more of them nested inside each other as you go towards the center. Well, apparently this is a structure that is a basic nature of how atoms and molecules form. It's a basic nature, obviously, of fruits. Fruits have different layers inside themselves, like the onion being the most extreme example. You see it in terms of the layers of the earth inside, like the mantle and the lithosphere and the core and the crust. You see it in terms of planetary magnetic fields, the different structures in the magnetic field. You see it in terms of the solar system's magnetic field and the orbits of the planets. You get nested spheres again. You see it in the galaxy, and you see it in the universe. I mean, it keeps reoccurring over and over again. Well, it also seems to occur in the mind. And it appears that in time-space, in this realm in which time is three-dimensional and space is only one-dimensional, that the mind is actually a series of nested spheres. And it took additional research and confirmation from my source to come to the conclusion that these nested spheres actually represent the chakras. In our physical body, it appears that the chakras are in different locations. You have a root chakra, which is your groin. The second chakra, the orange, is your lower abdomen. Then the third chakra being your solar plexus. The fourth is the heart. The fifth is the throat. The sixth, or the indigo, is your third eye, where the pineal is. And then the seventh is the crown, which is just directly above your head. Well, that's sort of like where in space-time these areas are located, but in time-space they're all a big set of nested spheres, and they're all interpenetrating each other. Each of them actually does represent part of your mind. And this is another fascinating concept. Remember I was talking before about the idea that the brain is just like an antenna.
Right.
And the actual mind is an energy phenomenon, not a brain phenomenon. Well, you know, if people say that a guy is thinking with his dick, that's actually not far from the truth. the root chakra, the groin chakra, in some cases is a center of cognitive activity, and you do have thoughts that originate from that energy center. Now, non-locally speaking, your brain is still the conduit for those thoughts to come in, but nonetheless, the Creator has given us physical locations in our body that represent these different levels in which our mind is actually working on an energy level. So when you're having a lot of issues with inappropriate sexuality or issues dealing with constantly living in fear, then you may very well get lower bowel problems, you know, colon polyps. You may get testicular cancer. You may get ovarian cancer. Women may end up having to have hysterectomies. They may get, you can get terrible things like diverticulitis. So what I'm saying is that if you go into like the Edgar Cayce readings and Louise Hay and things like that, each of these energy centers in which a part of our mind works and functions and that we're actually thinking with, those energy centers correspond to physical locations on the body, and those physical locations on the body will reflect dis-ease, right?
Mm-hmm.
Disease conditions from the mind as actual physical problems, physical health problems. Now, those areas do represent our thoughts, and a lot of people are not capable of even getting their cognitive activity above the solar plexus. They're not even able to think with the heart. They're only thinking with the first three chakras.
Right.
Then you also have a lot of people in the New Age who follow metaphysics and spirituality who are probably the type of people listening to this program. And not to criticize, but in many cases, we end up having the problem of being what I call top-heavy, in which we have lower chakra blockages. We are living in a lot of fear and a scarcity, feeling like we don't have enough. That's a root chakra blockage. Sexuality blockages are also root chakra blockages, either feeling sexually unfulfilled or feeling sexually unappealing to the opposite sex, whatever. Second chakra blockages, that's the second chakra of the orange, is all about your self-esteem and how you think about yourself. So if you have low self-esteem, if you're kind of feeling down in the dumps a lot and you're wondering why your life isn't working out and you just have a lot of issues with misery, that's a second chakra blockage. The third chakra, the yellow, the solar plexus, is other people. It's issues with other people. So when you have a blockage in that center, you're basically allowing other people to overpower you. You don't have enough self-respect to stand up for yourself and have healthy boundaries. You may be shy. You may have a terrible fear of public speaking, a terrible fear of asserting yourself in a group or in an audience or in a crowd. And a lot of times you end up attracting people into your life who are going to take your power as a form of teaching you to build up the strength of your third chakra. And another thing that's important about the third chakra is it's also the seat of will. The will, you know, in the Native American Indian shamanism, the will does emanate from the third chakra. And that is the center that kind of forms like an energetic tentacle that, if you read the Carlos Castaneda books, is used actually as like a third arm that they can energetically grab onto things with and move things with. And I do believe that some of the Castaneda books are actually genuine. It has been proven that some of it was, or even maybe a lot of it was fabricated. But people that worked with Castaneda have identified that the shaman Don Juan was actually a real man named Cachora. And apparently he's still alive. I had the opportunity to meet him at a conference, and he ended up having his flight held up, and he wasn't able to make it. But there is definitely some real stuff with all the shamanism, and the third chakra, again, is the seat of the will, and the seat that, like, also in the Tai Chi and such disciplines like that, where these practitioners develop very powerful abilities of mind over matter, almost invariably they're sending it out through the third chakra. So again, all that stuff has to do with your relations with others. Now, the fourth chakra is unconditional love, the ability to open the heart. The fifth chakra, the throat, the light blue, is all about wisdom and communication. So people who are open in that chakra will have the ability to communicate their authentic, true feelings, which is really a very important part of love for someone else, too. If you don't have communication, it's not going to go very far. And the willpower, the honor principle is very important in that center. The concept of, see, somebody who's totally focused in the heart center, they may be very loving, but they're not going to want to do something if they don't like it. Honor sometimes is about doing things you don't like, but doing it because you feel a sense of honor. Yeah. You may not always want to get up in the morning and take care of all the worldly responsibilities, but doing it out of a sense of honor is a very important principle, because it is an honor to be here. It is an honor to serve humanity in whatever capacity that means. Even if you have a job that pays $6 an hour and you're not very happy in what you're doing, you're still interacting with other people. You're still having connections, even if it's just to your immediate staff around you. And all of that involves a time that you can radiate your own realization of spiritual unity to others and help the planet. And
yeah,
also,
that's awesome.
Yeah, we also have an energetic effect on the human energy field. We can be like needles of light. And as you start to awaken your pineal gland, which is some of the material I'm going into now, that does give you the ability to make that bridge connection, to be able to not only better yourself, but better humanity in the process. And that's the so-called meditation effect that we're talking about in the movie. But that's a little bit further down in this little discourse I'm giving you here. Getting back to the pineal gland, getting back to Watkins and Sherman, and Watkins coming to Sherman after his death, and describing what he had to do to get a telepathic message to Sherman's mind. I've set up for you the visualization of spheres within spheres and the idea that each of these spheres represents one of the chakras. The next point I'd like you to look at is the idea that the biggest sphere on the outside is the red one. It's the root chakra. Now, this is a funny aside, and I don't want to take too many tangents here, but when I was in college, I went to see one of these Siberian Tuva throat singers. They are shamans who basically can generate two different tones out of their voice box at the same time, one of which is a very strange-sounding, low, raspy, rumbling noise. And then at the same time, they get this weird, heterodyning sound up on top, and they're actually able to blend those together and do different things with each one. And this was a woman who was doing it by herself with a guy who was a renowned jazz saxophone player. So it was an unlikely combination, but it actually was really cool. He was doing some very tripped out psychedelic stuff in odd key signatures and modes that are not like your typical major scale or minor scale, and it worked really well. So I was in the front row, and I thought there were speakers in the back of the auditorium because she was bouncing her voice off the back of the auditorium really effectively. I mean, it sounded like there was somebody behind me. And then it turned out that there wasn't anything. I actually turned around and looked, and there were no speakers back there. That freaked me out. So I said, well, heck, she's a shaman. Why don't I meditate and really get into this? Because all these college kids are just sort of sitting around with these stoned out looks on their faces, not really, you know, not sure what to make out of this, you know. So I'm in the front row, and I close my eyes, and I start meditating, and I'm doing this technique, which I recommend that you do this. You start out, first of all, you can actually tune into your heartbeat. You don't need to feel your pulse. If you actually get quiet enough, you can feel your heart pumping. And you start doing that, and then you go for 6 heartbeats of inhale, then you hold it in for 3 heartbeats, then you exhale for 6 heartbeats, and then you hold it out for 3 heartbeats. And if you keep on going, you can build it up to 4-8-4 or even 5-10-5, but you start with that 3-6-3, 3 heartbeats, you know, 6 heartbeats in, 3 heartbeats held, 6 heartbeats out, and 3 held out. Now, I think I was doing 4-8-4, or I got up to 4-8-4 while I was doing this, and these are long, slow breaths, because my heart wasn't going too fast. Now, you got to remember, by the time you're at the last, by the time you're at the 4th heartbeat of your exhale, you are very desperate for a breath.
Right.
Let's not kid ourselves here. And I got my eyes closed, and I'm very desperate for a breath. I'm on my 4th heartbeat, and all of a sudden, my chest seizes up like I'm having a freaking heart attack. It was terrifying. It was like somebody had kicked me in the chest. I can't breathe, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm having a chest spasm, and this is, I don't know what the hell to do. I didn't even open my eyes. I'm just, all of a sudden, and then the next thing I know, man, how do I describe this to you? I got thrown through a vortex, and I know it sounds really corny, but, I mean, I can't explain it. I can't explain what happened. It's like the near-death experience, people say they go through a tunnel.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happened, man. I mean, everything got dark, and there was a light, a pinpoint, and I feel this massive sense of a rushing sensation forward through space.
So you died?
I guess so.
Okay.
But what happened was I fly really fast through this tunnel, and I come up to this big ball of light. And it was red on the outside, and it was orange below the red, and then below the orange was yellow. And then I didn't see any colors between the yellow and the white in the center. And it looked like a big diffuse ball of gas, I guess. But the gas was arranged into what looked like spiraling arms of a galaxy. But they were blossoming out in a sphere. So it wasn't just a flat galaxy. These were like three-dimensional spirals that were kind of flipping around all the way from the top to bottom to the east to west axis and everything in between. So it looked like a big spiral, three-dimensional, fluffy galaxy, I guess.
Similar to the looking glass?
Yes, exactly. But more importantly, similar to the arrangement of chakras, right? When I said that
okay.
The red is on the outside of the ball, and then
uh-huh.
as you go inside the ball, it gets darker. You go through
okay.
the lighter, actually. You go red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, and then white. Well, all I saw was the first 3 colors. But when I got to this place, and I think I was seeing my soul from the other side, you know, like outside my own soul, looking back in
mm-hmm.
from the other side. I was actually looking at what Watkins was describing he saw when he had to try to get into Sherman's mind to form a channel. Because what Watkins was saying is that he would fly up to Sherman, and he saw these series of spheres nested inside each other. And in order to get a message through, he had to find a way to the center. Now, the problem that Watkins said he was having was that each of these spheres is violently moving, churning and spinning, and each on its own track, each doing its own separate thing. And so if you can imagine, like, different speeds of revolving, like you might have one that's revolving maybe 10 miles per hour, and then the next one is revolving 30 miles per hour, and the next one is revolving 45 miles per hour, there's only going to be certain moments when they line up. And it won't happen very often, but they're going to keep spinning through each other. And this isn't just simple revolving either. This is up-down movement, side-to-side movement, diagonal movement. And then
sure.
you also have things that are sort of like fading in and fading out. I mean, it's a mess. And that's what the average person's mind is like when they're not meditating. That's
David.
The punchline. Yes.
Are you familiar with DMT?
Of course. I mentioned it in the video.
Is that similar to the experience you're talking about when I've read about, or DMT appears supposedly at life and what is called death? I like to call it life and re-life is when it shows itself. And it's also very apparent in the pineal gland.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. I was just wondering about that.
Yeah. DMT stands for dimethyltryptamine. It is a naturally occurring compound in a particular cactus. There's two different forms that DMT is taking in terms of the drugs that people are using. There's 5-MeO-DMT, which is basically it's sort of a bufotenine derivative. Bufotenine is the name given to a psychedelic compound derived from the venom of a toad skin. It used to be called toad skin tea. The Peruvian shamans actually will kill these toads and then basically extract their venom from the skin and then dry it, and that dried powder forms a compound called 5-MeO-DMT that people smoke. And that is a very, very harsh trip. I have some friends who have done it. It just completely deconstructs your mind for about 15 minutes, and then you come back. It's a very scary experience. It feels like you're dying. In fact, a friend of mine gave this to one of his friends, and the guy completely had a panic attack and said, "Oh my God, you've poisoned me. I'm dying. You're killing me. What are you? Are you crazy? Are you, you know, what are you doing to me?" All this stuff. It was very, and he never wanted to do it again. So that one is a really scary, dangerous chemical. I do not think it's actually been made illegal yet in this country, but again, high caution factor on anybody trying that stuff. I have not tried either of these drugs that we're discussing. And the other one is called ayahuasca. And there's others too. There's Yopo, and there's some others that are not as common, but ayahuasca is the other common one. And it actually appears, from what I've heard, to be a combination of two different plants that have two different psychedelic properties. And apparently what it does is it takes that sort of amazingly violent rocket ship DMT part from the toad venom and smooths it out so that it happens over a longer period of time and without anywhere near as much violence to the psyche. That being said, it is my honor to remind people that any psychedelic drug, you do roll the dice, you do potentially play Russian roulette. It is possible that you could have a certain neurochemical imbalance going in that could lead to you becoming permanently disabled with schizophrenia. I have had friends that happened to. There was a guy I knew in college who had done too many acid trips, and he was not a very functional person. And I've heard other stories of guys that took acid and, you know, ended up just wandering the streets and become recluse and homeless. So it's dangerous, but there are, you know, if you have the guts, and I'm not recommending you do this, but there are people out there that are facilitating ayahuasca visionary experiences as a group. You do apparently vomit a lot when you do this drug, but all those disclaimers and caveats aside, it is true that the people that have this experience frequently report out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, contact with spiritual beings, journeys to paranormal realms, distortion of your sense of time and space. Another one that people have written me about that they want to know about is Salvia divinorum, which again apparently is legal. It's a smokable leaf. That, again, from some of the things I've heard, can be a very violent and disorienting and jarring psychedelic experience. Now, I have done LSD. I have done mushrooms. I did two different varieties of mushrooms. I did psilocybin and Amanita muscaria. I also did yellow hospital mescaline, which is basically just sort of a pharmaceutical psychedelic that they're actually giving to people who are already suffering from mental illness, because for some strange reason, if you give people who are already tripping out psychedelic drugs, it calms them down. In the same way that when kids are hyperactive, you give them a steroid, a stimulant like Ritalin, and it calms them down. So yeah, I took the yellow hospital mask and I took these other things, and what I can say from my experiences is that the bad trips were really, really, really bad. And the only reason why I kept doing it, for the time that I did, I probably did about 20 of these. I had a fish story and exaggerated to 30 after I got sober, but it actually was only about 20. Most of my trips were bad. I mean, people would say, oh yeah, man, I remember I had this great, amazing experience. Well, personally, whether you want to call it luck or what, I don't know. I never had a good trip. I really didn't. I kept tuning into the earth. I kept feeling the earth's pain as a sentient being, that we were doing horrible things to the earth, and that it was just terrified of humans and terrified of nuclear bombs and terrified of what we were doing to pollute the environment and polluting the water and polluting the air and our internal combustion engines and pumping out all the oil from the earth's crust. You know, this became like I became the earth and I was terrified. I was terrified of us. And that's a very disconcerting experience to have. And it was very vivid. It happened every single time I did acid.
So when you were doing this, when you were experiencing this trip or what I guess that is what it's called, a trip.
Yeah, I was tripping, yeah.
Were you going to that through a fear-based? I mean, everything you're telling me is fear. If there was no fear and you could go into the right side of the brain and just go in love and the euphoria of the love side of the brain, you know, it may have been a different experience. It sounds like to me, and I'm not one that's done this. I have done LSD before, but my experience with LSD was really, really quite different from what you're experiencing because it was a very loving kind of warm sensation. Mm. I'm a very right side. I live a lot off the right side of my brain. I'm a very right-sided person. So, you know, it may just be the perception of going in fear or going in love, you know, how it comes back to you.
Well, sure.
You know, and, I think
and I'm also, as a public figure, I have a responsibility to not be portrayed as the Pied Piper of acid or drugs. You know, I really don't want to try to get people to do this stuff.
My hope was to actually getting that DMT feeling just from the euphoria of your meditation.
Oh, absolutely. That is totally the punchline. The punchline absolutely does come back to the fact that you do not need these drugs. You do not need to play Russian roulette. I get every time that I go into meditation, I'm having equal experiences to the tripping but without all the scary side effects. Now you can't get to.
You're going in love, David.
Right, exactly. Now
and into that meditation with love.
Right.
Yeah.
Now I was a very, very messed up teenager. You know, 15, 16 years old. I started doing marijuana when I was 15 years old. And don't get me wrong. You don't start doing drugs as a 15-year-old kid because you're having a happy family life. I felt like I was a prisoner of my parents, and they both know this. And we've talked about this, and they are okay with me telling people this publicly. I didn't feel like I had a single day of freedom. And drugs were the only way that I felt that I could escape the almost suicidal burden that I felt in daily living. I just felt like a complete prisoner. And this basically took the shackles off of my mind. Now, the ideal response to a feeling of being imprisoned is not to run away into an addiction, because all addiction will do is it will postpone the actual healing. Because as soon as you get sober, all the stuff you were running from comes blasting out. And for me, it led to the point that I actually was self-medicating on a daily basis. I could not take life sober. I had to stay stoned in order to function, because the amount of shadows that were hiding in my closet, which I'm not saying I'm gay, I'm talking about the cosmic closet of being an ET on this planet and actually being an angelic being in a human body, of which there are probably 100 million people like that on the planet or more. I wasn't aware that that's what was going on, but I knew that I didn't fit in. I knew that I felt very different, and I knew that the people around me were in some sort of somnambulistic trance. that was causing them to devalue each other and manipulate each other and kill each other, and it just seemed so senseless, and I just didn't want to be here. I didn't like the earth. I didn't like myself. I didn't like my body, and I was miserable all the time. So the drugs were like a short circuit that kind of jumped me into these really amazing paranormal states of consciousness without any effort. But when you're that messed up and you're that out of touch with yourself and then you do a psychedelic drug, you darn well better buckle your seatbelt, because all of the lies and all of the false truths that you've been telling yourself are completely ripped away from you, and you are left face to face with your shadow. And it is terrifying, but ultimately it does produce a healing response. And in fact, tripping is what led me to get clean, because I realized in a psychedelic state that I was absolutely destroying my physical body. I was very devitalized. I was very weak. I just had no energy, no motivation, no sense of happiness unless I was using drugs. And I was a total addict. And that's the thing, you know. Some people are so enamored with what I do now, and then they have a teenage son or a teenage daughter that's using drugs, and they call me up when I used to do readings, which I don't do anymore, or they write me an email, and they're like, well, I'm so worried about my daughter, or I'm worried about my son. And I say, look, you know, I was just like them. If you were my parent when I was that age, you would have been terrified of watching the downward spiral that I seemed to be stuck in. You might not have even thought there was any chance that I'd ever pull out of it. And it looked pretty freaking grim. But the point is that every soul goes through the full spectrum of experiences from the darkest to the lightest and all points in between. And that is why I say again and again, every soul is precious beyond measure. And whatever horrible mess you might find yourself in as you're listening to these words tonight, it's only a paradox because you're seeing it that way. Every solution is available when you start looking. And tapping into your pineal gland, tapping into your higher self, primarily through meditation and through stilling your mind, is what forms the gateway that will solve all of your problems. And as you start solving those problems, it will help to get the steps in lined up for you to enact your potential. If you walked up to me when I'm this kid doing drugs 6 times a day, staying high because the pain was so bad, and you walked up to me and told me that I'd be living on a mountaintop in Malibu, California, working on a film, you know, having enough of an income that I can get by, having a nice place to live, and being able to do what I love and make a living from that, I would have laughed in your face. I didn't know what I was heading into in the future, and I really didn't care, because honestly, the only thing I cared about was the pipe and the bag and the high, and that was about it. I really didn't have much else to live for. All my conversations were about marijuana or experiences that I had on marijuana or acid. I really wasn't that interesting to talk to if you weren't talking about drugs, because I really didn't have much else to say. And again, this is unflattering stuff to reveal, but that was my life. I mean, I was an addict, and that it becomes your whole focus. It's everything that you think about. It's everything that you focus on. And I wasn't interested in going out to the bars. I didn't really drink. I wasn't interested in having a bunch of friends. I was pretty much a recluse. I had a few smoking buddies, and that was it. And when I got clean, it was very difficult. People say, oh my gosh, how could you, you know, marijuana is an addictive bullshit. I was having a terrible, terrible time getting clean, and it was like I had this insatiable desire to use again. There was nothing else in my mind, but I got to get a hit. I got to do one. And I just had to say, nope, I'm not going to do it. And this is the real deep work of spirituality. I'm very grateful for the fact that I went through recovery when I was 19. Because spiritual growth, if you really want to go for the master class, it's the hardest thing you're ever going to do. You are coming face to face with your deepest shadow, which ultimately is all about this feeling that God has abandoned you, this feeling that you're stuck here, that nothing has been working out for you, and you feel bitter, and you feel resentful. And you're resentful against the Creator, which ultimately is yourself. So it all does come back to self, lack of self-esteem, self-hatred. And so we do self-hating things. We're doing behaviors, cigarette smoking, alcohol drinking, whatever, spending all our money when we should be paying the bills. We're damaging ourselves. We're hurting ourselves. We're killing ourselves. And we're doing it because we feel like, well, things are so frustrating, they're so horrible. Who the hell cares anyway? What does it matter? Why should I allow myself to just get kicked and kicked and kicked and be tasting my own blood in the dirt as I've been thrown down in the ground by the others around me so many times? Forget about it. I'm gonna do something to get my share of the happiness right now. I'm gonna do this addiction, whatever the addiction is, because I need something. I need something to break this horrible pain that I'm feeling. And the most terrifying addiction in terms of trying to develop spiritually is when it comes back to how we try to manipulate other people. And even the people who are spiritually inclined and spiritually resonant are having that problem. They're having that manipulation. They just don't realize how it happens. And this gets back to, again, these are all things that, everything I'm telling you is very central to the idea of awakening your pineal gland. I have not veered off topic at all. When Watkins and Sherman are looking at that nested spheres, Watkins is saying, each of the spheres has all this churning activity, and you have to dodge through it as a spiritual being to get to the center. And the center is where you get the message through. Well, the center of the nest is the pineal gland. That's the gland on our physical body that corresponds to the center of this set of spheres on the other side. This shaman lady is doing this chant on the front of the stage. I'm lying there. I'm sitting there in the front seat of the audience. I'm breathing out. I have an apparent heart attack. I go in through this tunnel. I come to this light. It looks red on the outside, yellow, then orange, then yellow, and then white in the center. When I got to this place, I felt as if all knowledge in the universe was available to me. And remember now, I had a number of trips by this point. This was, I'd had 3 years of clean time by the time this happened. Well, this was way more powerful than any acid trip I'd ever had. This was much, much more powerful. And the available cosmic knowledge was much greater. And so I realized, wow, I have the answer to every question I could ever ask. It's already here. I knew that I would not be able to forgive myself if I left there without bringing something back. So I said, well, I got to ask a couple questions. And so I asked a couple relatively mundane questions, one of which was, I basically knew I was going to have to leave my girlfriend, my Japanese girlfriend. The source confirmed that was true. I asked a couple relatively mundane questions and got the answer. Another thing that was strange, which I did seem to get the answer for, was that my Japanese girlfriend had gone home over the winter break and had shown my picture to this Shinto priestess that she knew, a very, very powerful shaman in Japan. And without even asking the woman a question, the first thing that pops out of the woman's mouth as soon as she sees my face is, this man will become a very powerful spiritual leader on the planet. Very important spiritual leader. No, I'm sorry, she didn't say powerful. She said very famous spiritual leader. That was the exact quote. Very famous spiritual leader. Now, at the time, I had no idea I was going to be doing that, and it freaked me out. And I remember that when I got to this light, that was one of the things I asked, and it did basically say yes. And I just said, well, we'll see, you know, whatever. And I came back out, and all of a sudden, I opened up my eyes and I was able to breathe. The clamp removed off my chest. And I take this sudden gasping breath. And I kid you not, this is one of the freakiest things that's ever happened to me, and it makes the hair on my arm stand up just saying this right now. That woman was standing on the edge of the stage. She was looking right at me. She looked me in the eye. She nodded her head and smiled as I opened my eyes. And I realized right then and there, she did this. She threw me into the shamanic realm. She threw me into the spirit world somehow. Her will, that tentacle I was talking about that comes out of the solar plexus, she must have, like, thumped my heart or something and done something to sort of, like, knock me into the death state or as you were saying, the re-life state. And boom. I mean, I went to this crazy place and came back and you know, got to bring my backstage passes to prove that I went there in the form of these prophecies.
Wow.
So Watkins is describing, you know, that there's all these spheres that are rotating, and this is what I find so fascinating. He said to Sherman, the more you can meditate, the more you can quiet your mind down, the more these spheres that I have to get through stop moving, and they quiet down. So So what he was basically saying was that the thoughts that Sherman was having corresponded to the violent movement of these spheres. And to me, that is the ultimate truth of what we call esoteric anatomy, the anatomy of the chakras and how they function as the mind, as a non-local energy field. Your mind, when you're sitting there and you're all tied up in, as you were saying, Cheryl, the fear and the mundane concerns, the stress and the anxiety and the anger and the jealousy and the bitterness and the contempt and all these negative emotions, you're basically churning up your lower chakras, and you're causing all this disturbance and this interference. Well, the psychedelic drugs, what they basically do is they force your lower chakras to stop moving for a while. And it forces there to be a crack that goes through them so that you're suddenly, your mind, your actual conscious mind, is now no longer functioning by the rotation of the lower centers. See, as I was saying, your mind is actually the function of its environment, and the environment includes these seven energy centers and how they move and how they rotate and spin. And so your mind, everybody is a channeler. Everybody is in contact with God all the time. There is no reason why you can't do all the things I do and more. It just requires tuning in to the higher levels of the same basic consciousness frequency, because all of these different frequencies are happening simultaneously. But the key is that what your conscious mind focuses on only goes as high as the chakra that is spinning. So if you can quiet down the root chakra so that you're not sexually aroused and you're not in fear for your life, then maybe the root chakra will stop moving, and then your mind will function on the orange level. And then if you can feel good about yourself and have healthy, positive self-esteem, then maybe that chakra will stop churning around, spinning around. And then you'll get to the level that you can reach out to others. If you can have positive interactions with others, then maybe that chakra will stop moving around so much, and your heart will open. If your heart starts to open, then maybe that chakra will find a place of stillness and start to activate, and then you can focus on communication and focus on the wisdom and learning the secrets of the universe and having that honor principle that you'll do things that you have chosen to do even though you might not like it. You get that center moving, and then you go up to the third eye, the pineal, and that's where you start being able to do these psychic things. Now, you don't necessarily have to slow down all the other chakras to get the pineal going, but that's the best way to do it. Now, remember, what I said is, when these chakras basically are balanced enough that they're not spinning and churning all the time, your conscious mind, the actual mind that is thinking, the mind that you are constructing thoughts with, will be a direct conduit to your higher self, to these higher chakras, because now the other ones have stopped moving, and all that's left is the higher one. Now, even during the day, your conscious mind is all the different churning happening at once, so you might get little glimmerings of the higher centers coming through. The more you meditate, the more you balance the lower chakras, the more those spheres stop churning, and more of your mind is online, and it's functioning as a direct conduit to consciousness. So the core exercise, once you're ready for it, is to be able to wake up in the morning and remember your dreams when you wake up. Now, this is a discipline. It's called dream work, because you do have to do work to do it. You wake up in the morning, you have a pad and paper next to your bed, and pencil, rather. Or, in my case, you go right to the laptop and type it right into the computer, which I find to be much more effective. I keep my computer in suspend mode, so all I have to do is hit one button and it pops right up. And the night before, when I go to bed, I write down the day of the week, whether it's Wednesday, Thursday, whatever. I write down the date, and then I put a dash. So when I wake up in the morning, I write the time, 5:08 a.m. or whatever, and then I write whatever comments I need to write. I use my first initial. I use D and then a colon, and then that's just me, and I write whatever little thoughts need to be spoken of, because your mind needs to be acknowledged. So if your ego is having a thought here and there and it says, oh, you know, last night I was burning candles and I took a bath and whatever, you just write that down. Whatever your ego wants to think about, write it down so it's clear. Try to remember whatever was happening to you. Don't say, what was I dreaming? Say, what was just happening? Where was I? Who was I talking to? Was I in a good mood? Was I in a bad mood? What colors did I see? Because everything in the dream is ultimately a function of yourself. The dream is actually a landscape of the psyche. Everything in the dream is a part of you in symbolic form. That's what dreams are. Everything in the dream, every character is you, every situation is you, every landmark is you, every symbol is you. So all of those things that happen in your dreams are telling you a message, which is the single most important spiritual guidance you need to hear that particular moment. When I got sober, I started writing my dreams down within days of when I stopped using, and that has continued unabated for 15 years straight. I don't get them every morning, but I make an effort to try every morning. And if I don't get a dream, I write something down anyway. I write down whatever I did the night before or whatever I'm going to do that day. Even if I just have to pay bills or run errands or whatever, I'll just document that and journal it. So while you're in this state, and again, this is a very valid discipline, because what happens is you're learning to hold the channel to the pineal open while you're awake. And it's called mind awake, body asleep. When you're slowing down the lower chakras and opening the higher chakras, your body doesn't want to move around too much. You're really groggy. You might not even want to open your eyes. Some people call it light as a feather, stiff as a board, because your body actually does kind of get numb and stiff and not want to move, but yet you feel like you're floating. And so when you're in this state of mind, you also, it's very difficult to think. When you're in the proper trance state, it's very difficult to recall a specific memory. I mean, you might have a dream about a particular actress, and you might say, oh, you know, the actress in Tomb Raider. And you won't even remember the name Angelina Jolie, because you're just not thinking at a level where you can call up those kind of memories. You're actually thinking in the field. So your mind is functioning non-locally. Your mind is functioning online. And in that state, you may not remember very simple, stupid, obvious things that you'd be able to call up immediately when you're awake. But then the other benefit of being out there is that you can think, you can get symbolic information to come through, whether it's in a dream or ultimately in channeling, coming through in actual words. But if you've held yourself in a deep enough state of trance, your analytical mind is not going to be able to decipher that symbolism, because you shouldn't be analyzing anything. If you start thinking, if you start actually trying to think, you messed up. And this is that real Zen ballet dance that all the mystical Taoist teachings are talking about, where it's the koans, where they say, what is the hand of one hand clapping? What is the sound of one hand clapping? Or if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, did it really make a sound? All that kind of stuff is intended for you to contemplate emptiness and contemplate the mind that arises spontaneously when you're not thinking. So think about not thinking, that kind of paradoxical statement. Your mind actually doesn't do any work. That's the key. That's the essence. It's the flow. It's the flow of genius. It's the flow of improvisational music or great poetry or great art or whatever. You set your ego out of the way, and then things start happening spontaneously in your mind, and you don't need to do any work to get them to happen. They just show up. They bubble to the surface. You don't have to think. You don't exert any effort. And in fact, if you try to think, you feel yourself getting pulled out of this state of mind. And most people call it daydreaming. Well, guess what? What happens in your mind that you're calling daydreaming, that's actual data. That's real information. That's not just junk. That's not just useless trash. Pay attention to your imagination. Pay attention to the daydream, because guess what? It may very well be coming from the right place. Now, if you're in that state where you can remember new information from your dreams, another thing you can do is you're waking up and you're light as a feather, stiff as a board, mind awake, body asleep, whatever you want to call it, is just start paying attention to all that noise in the background, because you'll get visual images, you'll get emotional impressions, and you'll get, in some cases, sentence fragments. Now, when it was happening to me for years and I didn't know what it was, it sounded like there was a TV on in the background, and sometimes you'd hear fragments of sentences and then they'd just kind of come in and go away. It happened a lot when I was on drugs, that is true. Acid and marijuana would do that. And I just never listened to it. I remember when I was on psychedelic drugs that I would be standing and urinating into the toilet. And the sound of the urine hitting the water was an incredible burst of speech, almost too fast to make anything out of. But if I listened really carefully, I could get some of it. And that is a kind of shamanic technique. They'll advise you to, like, go to a stream and try to hear voices in the sound of the water. And that sounds schizophrenic, but I'm telling you, if you actually meditate and you listen to nature, it will speak to you. You will start to hear, eventually, if you try hard enough, you will start to hear things. So you wake up in the morning and you're trying deliberately to meditate and breathe out your thoughts. Don't let them happen. Don't engage the thoughts. Let them, you know, if you think about something like, oh my gosh, my car, I need to change the oil, it's been smelling really bad lately, something's, I gotta do that, fuck. You know, whatever, just let go of all those things. If they come up, just acknowledge it, say thank you for being there. Now I'm gonna go back to what I'm doing, which is thinking about not thinking and meditating. And then again, meditation is not about emptiness. People are like, oh my gosh, if I have any thoughts at all, it's bad. That's not true. It's not true. All you want to do is avoid the effort of thinking. But when you avoid the effort of thinking, thoughts will show up automatically. And people say, man, it's just brain garbage. I'm trying to get away from that. I want to just get to the point where I'm not thinking at all. Not really, because what's happening is that those things that you're discarding as garbage are actually the data. And then the key, all I did is I started to document the data. And that's the basis of remote viewing. You read the remote viewing protocols, they say do not analyze anything. Just take every single thing that comes into your mind as if it was important and write it down and document it. So I start hearing these little funny sentences, and most of the time I couldn't get the whole thing. I just get a chunk of it, and I just write it down in my little journal. And then after a while, I started to dictate it into a tape recorder. And, you know, this was in November 10th, 1996, I started doing this, and it was this phenomenal amount of information coming through. All this stuff that was embedded in symbolism and metaphor and allegory that you wouldn't have made any sense out of when you're in that mind-awake, body-asleep state. But then, afterwards, you actually go in there and you look at it and you say, my gosh, this is talking about this and this is talking about that. And I was getting prophecies of things that hadn't happened yet, and I was getting messages about myself and spiritual guidance and all sorts of stuff. So again, it's important as we head towards 2012 and we're heading through these changes that you don't run away from these pineal gland techniques, because what I'm describing to you now is really the deeper core of awakening the pineal. And I'm not saying you have to channel. In fact, channeling is something that shouldn't really be attempted on a day-to-day basis until you have a good working background in deep meditation. In other words, what I'm recommending is before you start actually trying to document it, that you take some time practicing and let yourself just go into it and let yourself hear the data and be in the space of hearing it without trying to write it down. I think too many people jump right from the first time that they start to hear things to trying to document everything. And it's very easy. The most difficult part of this entire process, I will kid you not, is that the ego is absolutely tempted to listen in on what is being said and add its own comments and feedback.
Mm-hmm. Ain't that the truth?
You're telling me, buddy. It is the problem. And that is actually what most channeling online is. Most channeling online started out as something authentic, and then people say, wow, I know where this is going. This is cool, you know. And yeah, talk about Atlantis and talk about the Stonehenge and talk about the... Yeah, and the next thing you know, more and more of it is them grabbing the helm and channeling in whatever they want to hear.
Yeah.
The only way that I am comfortable with a reading that I give someone is if I don't know anything that I said other than the fact that I was speaking words, and I have maybe a basic knowledge of the fact that certain words are being spoken in the moment, but I do not follow the continuity of what those words are saying. And that's a very big shift that a lot of people can't make because we are so terrified of doing something wrong, of being bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to be a bad boy. We don't want to be a bad girl. And we feel like, well, I can't just spout all this stuff and not know what the hell I'm saying. I got to make sure that I'm not saying something that's going to embarrass me.
That's right. it's that ego thing.
It is, man.
Because you got to defend that ego thing.
You got to let go and let God, as the saying goes.
Right.
And it's all about flow. It's about the flow of genius. Do you honestly think when a jazz musician is up there improvising at furious speed through this incredibly complex jazz tune, that he's actually thinking, okay, now I'm going to play the F Mixolydian scale over this B-flat chord, now I'm going to play the... No.
No, he's not thinking about anything.
That's right. It's just the spontaneous moment-to-moment existence in the now of that musical performance. It doesn't have anything to do with planning or forethought or little licks that he's learned that he's going to whip out at the right time. It's spontaneous creativity. And different art forms allow us to get into that flow. Every single one of these, I'm saying, is ultimately the tapping of the internal genius, which is through the pineal gateway.
Okay, so that, to take that analogy of a jazz guy,
right.
Is that what we can expect as we make the shift to 2012? I mean, is that kind of like it right there in a nutshell, that that's what it's going to be like?
It's like 1,000 times or 100,000 times more, but that's one way to look at it, yeah. We absolutely are going to be moving through, if the Ascension prophecies are correct, which I believe they are, what is happening sometime in the neighborhood of 2011 to 2013, thereabouts, is tantamount to the most breathtaking spiritual ecstatic experience that you could ever have in any of your lifetimes that will far outstrip the intensity of an LSD experience or anything like it that could be an experience of consciousness or an experience in lovemaking or an experience of the best movie you've ever seen where you're totally in tears at the end and you're just in awe of what this movie has done for you. There is nothing that you could ever think of, there is nothing you could even imagine to compare to what this is going to be like. And I would like to propose the idea that each one of you listening tonight, you are a billionaire. You are this rich kid set to inherit this tremendous amount of money. And you just have no idea that this inheritance is coming. And you're sitting there going, oh, I can't pay my bills, da, 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 it's so disappointing. I had a really key dream one time. I'd been doing all this spiritual service work for others and making very little money doing it. And then I had this dream where I went up to a fire department, and I was aware in this dream that I was in the afterlife state. And I come up to this huge pile of envelopes, and each of the envelopes had the name on it of someone who I had directly served in some form, mostly through the psychic readings, but other people as well. Every single one of these envelopes, the fireman points to the envelopes and says, open one of these envelopes, because these are all yours. And you can tell from what I'm describing what was in the envelope. They were bursting with $100 bills. I mean, like, fat. Each one of them probably had half an inch thick of $100 bills in it. And I said, what the heck is this? And he says to me, the kindness that you show to others in the physical world equates to what you could think of as money in this world. This is simply the beginning of the money that you have been earning. We're just showing you the beginning of it. And I was, I actually
wow.
did break down into tears in the dream. It was that intense.
Mm-hmm.
The service that you do here on Earth is actually very much paying off in the higher realms. And I know that's it's the age-old excuse that religions have used to enslave people. They say, well, do it for the hereafter. You know, you might be suffering now as you build our giant cathedral, but in the future you're going to be very happy with your 72 virgins or whatever. Well, some of that stuff is based on truth, and it doesn't mean that you should be prostrating yourself and doing everything for a cult or a religion and then, you know, in total self-denial in the process of anything physical pleasure. You certainly want to embrace your potential as a creator and a manifester so that you can actualize a healthy life for yourself in this lifetime. But think about the people that spend all their time pursuing worldly power, worldly success. Yeah, they might have a lot more money than you do. Yeah, they might be a lot more popular than you are. They might have their face on every magazine cover. But you can rest assured that the body is going to fall apart like a rotting steak. And it will die, and it will be crawled through with worms and pickled with formaldehyde so that people can look at you in the funeral home. That is going to happen to you. It happens to everyone. You cannot avoid death. After that physical body falls away, you could have as much gold and as much jewels and as many cars and as many mansions as you want. You don't take that with you. It's all just going to sit there for your heirs to inherit, or the bank if you didn't write a good will. You go up into the higher realms, and then all of a sudden you discover that the only currency in trade that has been stocked up for you up there is the kindness that you showed to other people. And so after 2012, your bank account will be largely dependent, and I'm saying energetic bank account, is largely dependent on how loving you have been. And when we go through this transition, we are moving into a state of consciousness and a body that is a light body. So this means that you will have instantaneous telepathic ability. You will have instantaneous healing ability. You will be able to levitate your own body and levitate gigantic objects just by thinking about it. You will be able to time travel, to move forward and backward in time. You will end up having access to the same technologies that are in the UFOs, the free energy, the anti-gravity. You will have access to the ability to appear to other planets with people that are still like we are and basically be the equivalent of an ET in a saucer, trying to help them without being able to directly appear unless they invite you by their free will. And in this state of consciousness, you are so focused on helping others that you actually forget to eat. This is one of the things the Law of One talks about, is that you get so ramped up in the service that you're not even, you're neglecting your basic physical needs, and that's one of the problems of the fourth density. So the Earth itself, this is another important point. When you rise up above a certain altitude in the sky, that's where the Earth is on the fourth density level. It's not on the level of the physical Earth. When I would go out of body and try to fly up into space, after I'd get above a certain height, there would be a new ground that would form underneath me, and it would happen repeatedly. These are the planes of existence, and when you go above a certain height, that's where the habitable fourth density Earth will be located. So there's going to be a splitting of the frequency level like that. And in this fourth density Earth, we have an opportunity to start over from scratch. We have an opportunity to decide if we want to continue to live in square buildings with square rooms, or do we want to live in pyramids and domes and teepees and such. We have an opportunity to decide, do we want to build a system of money where you have to pay to get things, or do we want to, as in the Celestine Prophecy, automate the production of the goods that we need and the services that we need, so that we can focus on doing our spiritual work. So we really do have the opportunity to start over from scratch. And a lot of people probably are so focused on the 2012 itself and on, is this real? Am I going to make it? If it is real, well, if you're worried about that, all you have to do is be more loving. If you don't think you're loving enough, then there's your answer. Try harder. It's very simple. All you have to do is be slightly more interested in loving people than manipulating and controlling them, and you're good to go for the ascension. It is not difficult.
Okay.
I think a lot more about what happens after 2012, and I'll just conclude on this. After 2012 is where most of my focus is going to be, because we're building a whole new world. And that, so all I'm doing right now in the way I look at my life is I'm really, really jamming to try to get as much done as possible, to get this message out to as many people as possible, to explain it as clearly as possible, so that I can feel good that when this vortex opens, that I have done as much as I can to try to get that message out in as many different ways as I can, so that I can go through this with honor, knowing that I did as much as I could, as valiantly and as high quality as possible, so that when we get there, that the path will have been laid, and many others are doing that too. And I feel like we've done a great show here. This is a keeper. So.
Oh yeah, David. This is as always. It's an honor to have you on our show, and certainly we're going to have you back again. And I can speak for everybody here that is throwing all these chats by so quickly that everybody enjoyed it. Everybody learned quite a bit.
Oh great!
DivineCosmos.com. Check it out. He's got everything going on there. David can tell you what's going on. Keeps it pretty much updated every day. And
well, the discussion forum is actually getting 100 posts a day, and we have 2,000 people in there. There's about 100 people online at any one time. So that's a rapidly expanding community that I recommend you check out if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, absolutely. And David, thank you so much again.
It's really been my pleasure.
Cheryl, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, I know you've been commuting.
I'm just vibrating so high, I don't think I'm going to be able to go to sleep.
Well, I know I got to go take a pee, and I got to listen to what it says. David, well, thanks again.
You guys have all gotten your boarding passes, so I expect you to use them.
Thank you, David. We love you. Peace.
I love you, too. It's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Okay. And
all
we'll
right,
see you
night.
This Thursday, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.